We're talking about a pollution investigation at a Minnesota manufacturing plant that has a connection to the Wisconsin border. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. This plant had released a cancer-causing chemical in White Bear Township for more than 15 years. And a news investigation uncovered efforts to move part of the manufacturing process across state lines to Hudson. Do you live in Hudson or western Wisconsin? Did you see reports about the company Water Gremlin moving some of its business to Wisconsin? What was your reaction? We're at 800-642-1234. Jennifer Merrily is a reporter and anchor at WCCO-TV. That's the CBS affiliate station in Minneapolis. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
So for Wisconsinites who might not recognize Water Gremlin, which makes these fishing sinkers and battery terminals, why is the company been getting so much attention in Minnesota?
Sure. They've been getting attention here since the beginning of the year. That's when the community just over the border in Minnesota and White Bear Township learned that the company had been releasing a cancer-causing chemical, and a chemical also known to cause birth defects, for more than 15 years. The company is required to self-report their air emission levels, and it was discovered that the company had, the numbers were not correct. And so once this was discovered, they started holding community meetings. And at the beginning of the year, the community really became outraged that there was this pollution that had been going into their community for a number of years that they were unaware of.
So how does Water Gremlin use the chemicals that have drawn these meetings and this public scrutiny from pollution regulators?
Sure. There's a couple different chemicals that we're talking about. The original one that they were using that was emitted into the air for a number of years was called TCE, and this is the cancer-causing chemical. And they used it in the process for their fishing sinkers and battery terminal posts, as we understand. After it was discovered that this pollution had happened, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency ordered that the company stop using the chemical TCE. They were shut down for a certain amount of time, and there was a settlement with the state. It's the second largest settlement in Minnesota history. The company was ordered to pay $7 million in fines and corrective action. And as part of that, they started using a different chemical, a less toxic chemical, often referred to as DCE or TDCE. And they started operations again, trying to make the same products using this other alternative chemical. And they had a certain amount of time to have their pollution control equipment working to be able to capture the emissions of this new chemical into the air. And they had problems for months trying to get this working. In fact, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency gave the company extensions to try to get their pollution control equipment working. When they finally tested it, it was only working at, I believe, 25%. So it was not working the way that they wanted it to. So this chemical, these emissions, has really been the problem for even in the months since it was found that the company had been releasing, you know, chemicals into the air in an unsafe way for a number of years. Even when they moved to the new chemical, they still were having problems getting their pollution control equipment working the way that it should be.
We're talking about a company under scrutiny from Minnesota pollution authorities that found a way to operate in Wisconsin. Reporter Jennifer Merrily has been investigating Water Gremlin for WCCO-TV. That's a CBS affiliate station in Minneapolis. You can join in. Do you live or work near one of Wisconsin's state borders? Have you seen companies move some of their business across the border due to different state regulations? Join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Jennifer, at one point in your investigation, you followed this truck leaving Water Gremlin in Minnesota, and then you end up in Hudson, Wisconsin, across the Mississippi. What did you learn? What was happening?
Sure. So at some point, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency partially shut down Water Gremlins operations in White Bear Township here in Minnesota. That was because they could not get their pollution control equipment working the way that efficiently here, and they could not get their emissions of the new chemical under control. So we started looking at what Water Gremlin was doing. And I ended up following a truck from Water Gremlin's facility in White Bear Township in Minnesota across the border into Hudson. And what we found was that Water Gremlin had partnered with a company out of Hudson to take over that coating process, that portion of the business that had been shut down in Minnesota.
Oh, they were outsourcing.
They were. So they partnered with a company, and so what we found was that the Wisconsin DNR, who does the permitting process in Wisconsin, had issued a permit to that company that Water Gremlin partnered with, and that company was in Hudson. Now, the permit did say that they are doing the work for Water Gremlin out of White Bear Township, that they would be doing the coating process for them. The parts would be, you know, transferred to Hudson, and then when they were done, they would either go back to Minnesota or go to the end destination.
So almost in a way circumventing, working around some of these legacy pollution issues in Minnesota was to outsource this process in Wisconsin?
Right. So we say that they tried to circumvent the system. They couldn't work here in Minnesota. They moved across the border, and it takes a long time to get a permit. So this had been in the works for some time before they were partially shut down in Minnesota. And we also learned that the equipment that had been used in Minnesota was being moved into the facility in Hudson. So they plan to do that coating process in Hudson. And we put this investigation on the air on a Monday. And by midday Tuesday, that company in Hudson said, we're not doing business with them. We are taking steps to terminate our contract. And by the end of that day, so less than 24 hours later, we did have confirmation that they had terminated the contract and that the two companies would not be doing business and that this coating process for Water Gremlin would not be happening in Hudson.
So what is the status of Water Gremlin's operations today?
Currently, they are still partially shut down. That process that they were planning to start over in Hudson at the end of August, that we knew that this was happening, is not going on yet. They have a number of new pollution violations in the last few weeks, and they are in the process, we understand, of implementing some new systems, a mitigation system, and some other things to get it under control, and they are working to resume operations here in Minnesota.
And as we wrap up here, you talked with Water Gremlin's partner company in Hudson, Hi-Tech. We know that they severed the agreement with Hi-Tech. Is there any other activity going on with this company, or will they look to outsource in Wisconsin in the future?
We don't know. All we know right now is that any time that they try to do something in Wisconsin, they will have to get a new permit. But if it's under another company name, we might not know about it. We found out about this, but if it's not in Water Gremlin's name, it'd be hard to find. The other thing that we learned about this is that Wisconsin DNR told us they would not look at Minnesota's history with this company. It was a new permit. It was a new company. Even though they were doing the work for a company with a history of pollution problems, that would not have factored into their permitting process.
Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Merrily is a reporter and anchor at WCCO-TV in Minneapolis. Coming up, we look at the school day and lunchtime. We'll talk cafeteria time after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about school, lunch, and what a condensed time to eat means for nutrition. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. There are the national standards for nutritional quality of school lunches, but no standards on how long kids get to actually eat their lunch. And researchers have found that kids who get less than 20 minutes end up eating a lot less on their tray than kids who aren't rushed. Parents, are school lunchtimes a concern at your school? How have you seen it affect your child? And students, weigh in quick here before school starts. Do you get enough time to eat? We're at 800-642-1234. Jim Deegan is a school nutrition manager for the school district of Janesville. Jim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
And Gay Anderson is with us as well. She's a school nutrition specialist and president of the School Nutrition Association, and that's a national nonprofit organization. She's also a child nutrition director for a district in South Dakota. Gay, welcome to you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you having me.
Well, let's start with you, Gay. We know that students in elementary school through high school are lucky if they get 20 minutes to eat their lunch these days, but is that really all schools? How common is this?
To be very honest with you, we don't have any set standards at this time. And it seems like, as you mentioned, the 20 minutes, we're seeing and hearing more and more that our lunches are being shortened up in the course of every day. And so many times it's because of the education process that takes place, squeezing extra curriculum minutes in. And so for us, it's really hard to be able to say exactly how many schools get that. I am very blessed in my own district that my students at least get 20 minutes of seat time. That doesn't mean the time going through the lines, but many times it's 20 minutes just getting their lunch and trying to consume it.
Well, seat time can mean, as you say, different things because there's that time that you have to go through the line to get the food. There's that time of opening up your or eating what's on your tray and opening up the containers on your tray. So it might mean for a kid who's at the end of the line starkly different than 20 minutes. Is that right, Gay?
Oh, most definitely it can. It can also make a difference, and I'm sure Jim can agree with me, that when students go through the lines, actually, depending on what's on a menu, some days it may take longer to serve things, and some days you've got a fast-serving menu. And so all that does make a difference, along with the different kinds of foods that we're offering these days. Fresh fruits and vegetables take a little bit longer to chew.
Yeah. Jim, last week standardized test scores were released in Wisconsin, and some experts are saying one of the reasons we're seeing lunch times decreasing is because schools are under a lot more pressure to increase instruction time. What are you seeing in Janesville?
Janesville, typically we're talking about 20-minute lunch period. The middle school, high school lunch line is a little bit longer, which kind of surprises me. The older kids have more time to eat. But I agree with Gay that 20 minutes is usually the standard, and that's time that's from the start to the end of the lunch period. I remember seeing kids when I first started this job in Milton years back and watching their lunch line, and it was 18 minutes. And there would be 100 kids in line, and by the time the last student went through, they were eating food on the way to the garbage can to dump things out. They just didn't have, they had 7 or 8 minutes to eat lunch.
Gay, what else is encroaching on the time that kids get to eat lunch? Is the growth of student populations a factor here?
That definitely has had some impact, especially in the high school situations. What we're hearing is school districts are going to things called power hours, where they just release all the students at one time. And a power hour doesn't necessarily mean an hour. And so the students in a large high school facility all released at one time are not going to go and stand in a long line waiting to get their lunch, so they opt not to eat. Or if they have open campuses, they choose to leave. And so that's a little concerning, too, because there are so many factors in the education process. I always say that we make a huge difference in the lives of the kids we feed. And it comes down to making sure that a well-fed child is ready to learn, basically.
We're talking with Gay Anderson. She's a school nutrition specialist, president of the School Nutrition Association. Jim Deegan is here as well, school nutrition manager for the school district of Janesville. You can join in. Are you a student who doesn't have a lot of time to eat your lunch? How has that changed the way you consume food at school? Have you come up with different strategies to eat what you need? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Peter now in Viroqua. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind about school lunch?
Well, my boys go to a private Waldorf school in Broca, Wisconsin, and one of the factors that played into us wanting our children to go there was just that there's this emphasis on trying to reduce stress and anxiety, and one of the ways they do that is by giving the students about an hour and a half for lunch, and it's a combined study hall lunch period. And it was started out last year as an experiment, and the school is sticking with it, and I think it's really a benefit. It reduces stress. It gives kids a chance to socialize, gives them a chance to have really a good, slow, healthy lunch, and at the same time sit down with friends and do some homework. We live about a block away. It's an open campus, so our son comes home, has a lunch at home, and has time to practice piano and do some homework. So we're really happy with this. And I know that it's unique because it's a small school, and I know that bigger schools have a bigger challenge.
Well, Peter, thanks for bringing your situation. Jim, this is also about socialization here and letting kids sit down with each other and have some conversation. What do you make of that?
I think it's especially important for the younger students with today's society and everybody communicating electronically, being able to sit down and learn how to have conversations, how to be respectful of each other, learning manners, different things like that all take place within the cafeteria.
Gay, what do you think of a combined study hall / time to eat, lunchtime?
To be honest with you, it sounds like a great idea. There's a lot of different thinking going on right now about how can we get some of, you know, these new ideas such as that brought into the education process. And we're hearing of some schools trying to brainstorm or bring in the fact that they do a study hall lunch, or that they're now letting their students eat their lunch in the classroom so that they just at least have some time to consume their food. One of the concerns with having such a short time to eat, that, you know, there's a huge concern about childhood obesity, but tie that into not having enough time to eat. Sometimes it's you may be scarfing your food down so fast that you don't realize that you're full. So it can cause some, you know, different effects that people could learn to eat so fast that in the end it's creating some other issues. So there's a lot of different things that tie into this.
And Jim, you've said that the number of kids receiving free meals under the National School Lunch Program affects the amount of time kids have to eat. Do you see this happening in Janesville?
Well, we have some schools that are community eligibility provision schools, which means that we provide free meals to all kids in the school. And typically those schools, about 80% or more of the kids eat on a daily basis. Where my other schools, you're looking at about 65% of the kids eating. So you're picking out more kids in lunch line in those schools, and you still have the same amount of time to eat lunch. And I also am concerned about the time period because of the amount of waste that people talk about with the National School Lunch Program. And I feel that the waste is directly related to the amount of time we give kids to eat. If the kids have longer periods to sit down, they'll actually consume the fruits and vegetables, which take longer.
It takes longer to eat those fruits and veggies. And so, Jim, it sounds like they're eating the things that can go down pretty quickly, that they can consume and then just be able to run off.
Yeah, they're making choices. And I don't feel, you know, we offer a wide variety of fruits, vegetables, proteins, grains, and they're making choices of what they eat based on the amount of time they have to eat.
Gay, some low-income children rely on their school meals for half of their daily energy intake. Do these time restrictions affect them differently than other kids?
I think, well, it affects all kids. It really does. And going back to being well-fed, you're ready to learn. I do kind of just want to go back with what Jim said, if I may, about the food waste. And so often we hear in the national news, you know, about schools wasting so much food. The food isn't wasted in the kitchen end of things. It is the waste at the garbage cans. And we're trying to change that perception because we could not continue to do our jobs and have a lot of waste, you know, on the serving end of things. But when we see all the waste that goes in the garbage cans, you know that it's the fact that it's the items that you see, it's always the fruits and vegetables first that are going in the garbage can because it takes longer to chew.
We're talking about the squeeze on school lunch periods and how schools are dealing with it. Gay Anderson is president of the School Nutrition Association. She's a nutrition director for a district in South Dakota. Jim Deegan is a school nutrition manager for the Janesville district. Teachers, have you seen shorter lunch times change the way your students operate during the day? Are they trying to eat little meals in class? Are they more tired? What are you seeing? Where is the solution? Bring your perspective, 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this issue after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's a ritual shared by millions of school children each year in cafeterias across the country. We're talking about lunchtime and how long kids get to eat. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. Is your kid coming home from school with their lunchbox almost completely full? Nutrition researchers have found that the length of the school lunch period factors into ensuring that kids eat healthy. School nutritionists and administrators, what is happening at your school? Are you looking at options to try to get more time for kids to eat? Or has your school pared down the minutes for lunch? What's behind that? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jim Deegan is a school nutrition manager for the Janesville District. He stays with us. And Gay Anderson is here. She's president of the School Nutrition Association. Let's take a call now. Jesse is joining us from Washera County. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. I understand you're a teacher.
Yeah, I'm a high school teacher, and our lunchtime is also shorter, at least way shorter than when I was a kid. And so it's not uncommon for kids to come in to the period after lunch and ask, hey, is it okay if I have my food with me? And I'm fine with it as long as it's not a problem, but I'd rather them focus on my math class. But I mean, it goes to Maslow's hierarchy. If you're not eating, you're not going to be able to learn.
Right. So you're allowing them to perhaps snack a little bit or finish up during math.
Yeah.
How many students might that pertain to? Do you see a number of your students doing this?
At the beginning of the year, not a lot do it, but then throughout the year, more and more pick up that I let them do it. So then it becomes I have about half my class is how much I had last year bringing food in just because they don't have enough time to eat.
Is your school addressing this in any way? Is there any movement on it?
I mean, we are trying to get class time, shorten the lines. So we have an A lunch and a B lunch, and then there's a fourth period A that will, during that first lunch, will go to class, and then during the second lunch, there's another fourth period. But it is not, I don't think it helps that much. It helps a little bit.
Yeah, so staggering the students going to lunch. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for your situation, for bringing that in. Gay, do you see that where teachers who have students right after the lunch period that they're letting those kids eat?
Well, again, we are hearing that some of that is happening. And to be honest with you, if that helps with some of the solution, I think that's great if teachers would allow that. In many situations, sometimes people don't feel that students should be eating in the classroom. But, again, it comes down to trying to help create and find solutions in ways that we can help these students finish their meals.
Jim, it sounds like staggering the lunches, like an A lunch and a B lunch, and students kind of rotating in, that might not be the full solution here.
I don't believe it is. then you run into issues where you've got disciplinary problems within a classroom or a teacher has in a classroom. And at times we've seen where they've held kids back, which they're not on schedule coming when they stagger the lunch periods like that. And then you're giving kids a little bit less time in it doing that situation. I don't think it's beneficial doing that. And then we also have principals in schools who aren't as kind and don't allow food to go out of the cafeteria. You know, you have to worry about rodents and pests and different things like that when you start spreading food throughout the entire school building. So that's also an issue.
And with staggering lunch periods, some of these students also may be eating lunch quite early in the morning when they may not be hungry and therefore may not, you know, really be ready to eat. What do you do then, Jim?
Well, you have to realize a lot of these schools are older buildings. And when they first designed them, they were designed for lunch only. And the kitchens are just too small. The cafeterias are typically too small. Then they'll do referendums and add on to the school building with more classrooms. So you're increasing the population of the building, but you don't do anything to increase the cafeteria size. So staggering lunches is probably the only solution that they have, but it isn't an effective way to address the question.
Gay, what do we know about the way kids learn when they are properly nourished?
Actually, the School Nutrition Association, I think I referenced it earlier, we have a tagline. It's feeding bodies, fueling minds. And we do know that when we're well-fed, we're focused on what we do. We as adults know that. If we have breakfast in the morning and we're able to focus on all the way until lunchtime, same thing with lunchtime. If we're able to have a good, healthy, nutritious meal, we are a little bit more focused. And so it all ties into that whole learning process. So we do need to have that time. We need to find that time because teachers and administrators are all looking at scores, and they want to see that those students are succeeding. Well, bring us into the part, the conversation then, so we can help try to address that issue.
We're talking with Gay Anderson. She's president of the School Nutrition Association and a nutrition director for a district in South Dakota. Jim Deegan with us as well. He's school nutrition manager for the school district of Janesville. Your thoughts on this? What do you think is a solution to this bigger issue of dwindling lunch times? Teachers, have you seen shorter lunch times change the way your students operate during the day, operate during your class? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Matt now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
What's on your mind about school lunch?
I was wondering, why are we reducing the lunch time rather than extending it in this situation? I mean, if children are already asking to eat during classes, should we be looking to giving them more time to do so?
Great question, Matt. You know, it was the line's a little fuzzy there. Jim, you know, he's asking, why don't we just extend the school day so we can account for a proper lunchtime?
Well, teacher contracts and balancing budgets are a huge issue that superintendents and school boards need to deal with every year. And the length of the day would become longer, and that is their number one expense that they have typically in most school districts. So if we're making the day longer, it's going to cost a little bit more to contract with teachers. And teachers are overburdened as it is right now. So asking them to do more or add more to their day without compensation to me doesn't make much sense.
Gay, is there anything you'd like to add there from your thoughts in South Dakota and from the association and why we can't just extend the day to fit in a proper lunch?
Well, it kind of comes down to, again, I agree with what Jim said, but I also want to add the fact that we keep adding so much into the curriculum expectations, and there are so many different things expected in the learning process that focus gets stretched a little bit more. You take another 5 minutes for this and extend, you know, classroom periods by 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there. And so where do you take that extra time away from? You take it out of that lunch time. The one interesting thing is teachers, I know in my own state and many across the country, they have mandated half-hour lunch periods. Well, if they have a mandated half-hour lunch period, why don't our students have a mandated half-hour lunch period?
Let's go to Amanda now in Stevens Point. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am the parent of a senior high student here in Stevens Point. We actually have the largest three-year high school in the entire state, and they already stagger their lunches, and my daughter tells me very routinely that there is never enough time even just to get in line and get food before she has to go to her next class. And the teachers, they don't even try to stop them from eating in class because there's no point.
Wow. Do you see any movement there of a change coming ahead because they already are staggering, Amanda?
At this point, they have changed their schedule, and Wednesdays they have an advisory period, so the class times are already shortened on Wednesdays, and the buses, you know, it's the scheduling of the buses to get the kids, you know, to the junior highs and the elementary. I mean, I don't know how they would even be able to extend any part of the day other than, you know, making every one of the schools have to go longer, which is not something that that I've seen our community being behind.
Ah, Jim Deegan, it sounds like there would be a domino effect.
This is a difficult issue. You think it would be something that could be solved relatively easily, but it isn't that way. I've often had thoughts about making lunch period a scheduled class period, do some instructional, provide instructional material can take place in the cafeteria. And you could do that with different signs or videos or posters, just trying to teach kids about farm to school and school gardens and learn where their food comes from. There's a huge disconnect now between students and where their food supply comes from. And I don't think they really understand where the things they eat are raised or grown.
Yeah, so incorporating some instructional projects there into lunch. We're looking at the time schools allot for lunch and the effect that a shorter lunch period has on students. We have two nutrition experts here. Jim Deegan, school nutrition manager for the Janesville District. Gay Anderson, president of the School Nutrition Association. And you as well. Are you a student who doesn't have a lot of time to eat your lunch? How has that changed the way you eat lunch? Do you eat particular foods first because it's faster? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment for more on this here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the school lunch period. I came across a recent parent blog entry that encouraged parents to practice school lunch with their kindergartners at home. Set a timer, show them how to prioritize the good stuff. Pack food that is bite-sized and can fit in one hand. And this tip, it's set to practice opening and closing food containers so it saves them time and frustration. What are you seeing with school lunch period from where you are? Have you found solutions in your district that are giving kids more opportunity to finish their meals? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Jim Deegan is school nutrition manager for the Janesville District, and Gay Anderson is president of the School Nutrition Association. They stay with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Jennifer is with us in Wanakee. Hi, Jennifer.
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
I'm actually wondering, I wanted to talk to the nutritionist about the impact that eating quickly might have sort of indirectly on contributing to the obesity epidemic, as kids are sort of eating too quickly for hunger cues to catch up, and so they're eating as much as possible to fuel the rest of their day. And I'm wondering if there's any effect of that, and then also to the point of classroom time being used, perhaps that could be integrated into a health curriculum.
Great questions, Jennifer. Gay Anderson, what do we know first about this being tied at all to the obesity epidemic?
Well, I alluded to it a little bit earlier, and it does have a huge impact on that. The students are going to be looking at their tray and knowing what they can eat quickly. They're going to probably choose the things that they can chew quicker, swallow quicker, and sometimes not always the most healthy options, although we serve healthy options, but they aren't getting some of those other things within their meal. And as I mentioned earlier, when we train our bodies to eat so fast, we don't take the time to feel that satiation point where, oh, I'm full. You know, that triggers that down the road in people, and then that does contribute to the obesity issue, I believe.
Well, Jody from Oconomowoc called in, couldn't stay with us, but is a retired teacher, and she wanted to speak specifically to something she heard earlier, saying, you know, teacher contracts have been an issue as far as extending the day for lunch, but Jody believes teachers would be glad to extend the school day so kids could have more time to eat. Jim, do you hear this sentiment at all from teachers?
We do have a lot of support from teachers. Teachers are concerned about the welfare of the students, and I think there is a lot of support from teachers, yes.
Let's bring in Allison now in Racine. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments. The first one is just kind of on the ripple effect of eating too quickly. I think this also doesn't allow kids to see food as something that is pleasurable and that they could be interested in. And they just see it as something they have to kind of gobble down and as fuel. And I think that has a really bad negative effect kind of moving forward as they become older and into adulthood, seeing food in that way. My suggestion, another comment, is I'm wondering if schools could invest in extra carts to put in the cafeteria or lunchroom where they could create more lines and serve the kids more quickly so the kids have more time to eat, and maybe districts could have these portable carts that they share between schools, because I know lots of schools within the same district have different start times, so they would also have different lunch times, and that might help in, you know, dispersing the cost of those carts more effectively.
Allison, thanks. Jim, let's pick apart the last part there. What would portable carts look like? Is that a possible solution?
You know, I had a list of solutions, and to me that was the number one item, being able to increase the number of serving lines in schools, and you're dealing with infrastructure and just the space that you have to work with. You know, we've got built in typically one or two different lines at the elementary level, but then you're talking about the cafeteria, which is also a lot of times the gymnasium or a multi-purpose room, so there's a lot of different functions that take place within that space. So being able to have the time or move out into that space and then get cleaned up and move back out of that space doesn't fit in the day's schedule.
Gay, Allison was saying there that the students start to see food as just for energy and not something to be enjoyed. Is there something to that?
You know, I really liked her comment, because it does come down to a little bit of where Jim, going back to what Jim said about making the lunchroom kind of an education area. If we can show and demonstrate that food is part of the learning process, that we learn where our food comes from, and we learn about that, we learn about some of the nutrients, that's a very key piece. And when we realize that, oh, if you eat different colors of your fruits and vegetables, you're getting different vitamins and sources for your intake there that are very important. And it comes down to something that we all are required to have is we do have wellness policies. Every school district that's with the National School Lunch Program is required to have a wellness policy. And in each policy, there is a mandate in there that we provide some nutrition education. And so that's where, when Jim brought up the fact that we want our lunchrooms to be, you know, a nutrition education piece, oftentimes that's the only place that we can have even just some signs and posters to show kids, because there isn't enough time in the day to teach the kids that in the regular curriculum.
talking with Gay Anderson. She's a school nutrition specialist and president of the School Nutrition Association. Jim Deegan here as well, school nutrition manager for the school district of Janesville. Still time for your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Gay, we came across this Lifehacker article that was encouraging families to practice a faster lunch, practice opening and closing containers with their little ones. Should parents be helping their kids prepare for the lunch rush?
I think it's always great when parents are involved in helping prep their children for what's going to be coming in the school day. And while I advocate for wanting to feed our children our school lunch meals, obviously, it's great also that, you know, they can have their home lunches brought, their lunches brought from home. It is important that they understand that, you know, you have to find that time and make that time to practice going through it. We actually teach our students, our little ones, going through the line just to be quiet and to say please and thank you at the items they want so we can feed them quicker. And it's just, it's a whole communication process. It starts at home, and then it also works with those of us in our school districts that we have to help educate teachers. We have to work with the PTAs and continue to educate everybody in the school district.
Jim, what about your little ones in Janesville and the learning curve that they have in eating faster, eating right when they sit down?
It's reiterate what Gay just said. It's a process. It's an educational process, and any hope that, or any help we get from the parents in preparing them before they start school is greatly appreciated. It's a learning session, and these are lifelong skills. Learning what you're going to eat, learning what you put into your body, what portion sizes are, different things like that, help improve the mental and physical wellness of our students.
Well, in the last moments that we have, Gay, there's a parent in Washington State who submitted a resolution to the National Parent Teacher Conference to address school lunchtime at their convention this coming summer. How could the backing of a national organization make a difference?
Tell you what, we applaud that. In our last position paper that we put together this year, and I believe it was February or so, and presented to Congress, we are asking to see if we can find a way to start meeting with other organizations like the parent-teacher associations, superintendents organization, business officials, school boards, and see if we can't get together and come up with a solution that we can all work on together and focus on. And this would have to start from the Department of Education on down. And we would gladly work with them in any way possible so that we could come to a nice solution that takes care of feeding our students properly.
Gay, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Gay Anderson is school nutrition specialist, president of the School Nutrition Association. She's also a child nutrition director for a district in South Dakota. Jim, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Jim Deegan is a school nutrition manager for the school district of Janesville. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.